Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Angunut Chatterjee. Angunut Chatterjee is a professor of social and cultural anthropology at California Institute of Integral Studies. She's from India and has been working back and forth between India and all kinds of other places, but mostly the Bay Area here in San Francisco. I guess maybe that's not exactly correct, but I know you spend a lot of time here, but you do so many things. I know you must be moving around a lot, and this is a very interesting school in itself. And Angunut has been working with many different issues of sustainability, globalization, policy, and advocacy research. She's been connected to saving the forests in India, public lands reform in India. Her work addresses issues of gender, caste, tribal class, and human rights, people's governance, development, displacement, migration, and policy reform, just to give people a little bit of an idea of the huge range of things, although, of course, they're all connected, that you're involved in. So maybe just to kind of get grounded here, you could talk a little bit. I know you're going back to India just in a few weeks, and I'm really happy to have been squeezed into your busy schedule yet. So just a little bit about your work in India, what you're going to go back and do this summer.
Thank you, Sue. I'm going to go back to India in the end of June, very beginning of July. And among other things, we're going to be looking at the intersections of globalization, development, and nation building that leaves mostly tribal and poor communities destitute. The whole process of development is one that is of dominant imagination. It is one from which the privileged stand to benefit, and it is one that often pushes out poor people from their homes and therefore consequently from their cultures, and they end up as casualties of development in city slums. And I'm working on assessing development vis-a-vis human rights in two areas in Orissa. I work only with social movements, so it's not independent research, so to speak, but it is something that we defined collectively as needing to be done. And there is also, to do that, one needs to understand how development can be imagined differently. And one of the things that I'm also doing is a very small watershed development project in conjunction with Dalit, that is erstwhile untouchable communities in India, in Orissa. And it's to see how runoff water can be connected to two different villages so that they might use it to farm. This is a community that lives on sustainable agriculture, and they're only able to get one crop. It's a drought-prone region. And what we're trying to do is deepen the storage facility, the pond in the village, and some other very simple watershed management projects. And it's incredible and glaring to see how little investment it takes to free up energy, time, to enable empowerment, to have crops, to have food, to have security. And then in contrast, you see in another area, for example, Kashipur in Orissa, where three tribal community members were shot dead by the state police on December 16th, 2000. And their crime was that they were protesting the unconstitutional mining of their lands. There is in India, there's a clause that says that tribal lands, one requires permission from the community before one might mine or, you know, undertake any such activity. And their permission or consent, of course, was not sought. And the state's response to people's protesting irresponsible globalization is to send the police out and open fire on communities. As you know, in Western India, there's the Narmada Dam that is coming up, and the height was recently raised from 95 to 100 meters, 5 meters, without the consent consent of communities without adequate provision for rehabilitation. And in India, like in other places, it seems that development has become the war that the state rages on disempowered people. So that's part of what I'm going to be doing, is going to Orissa to work, then going perhaps to the Narmada Valley, and also to Gujarat, where last year, as you know, there was a state-abated carnage against minority Muslim communities. It left about 2,000 people dead. And there are post-carnage rehabilitation measures have been extremely shoddy and inadequate. And there are some colleagues who are getting together to look at the situation now. And I'm going to go and go there as well in solidarity.
Great. Well, you're going to have a busy time, and we all, us activists, have a very busy time these days because things are kind of going from bad to worse. I like to say, even before, you know, all this war business carried on by the often by this country, but not only by this country, there are enough environmental issues that are really going to put us out of existence if we don't deal with them. And poor people always get the bad end of the deal. And this word development, I know, is usually means making more money for the big companies. So when you say redefine development, let's say a little more about that.
See, development is not simply the building of wells or dams or roads. It's most importantly the construction of political and social will to enable justice, isn't it? I mean, who should development be for? India, as you know, is once colonized, now post-colonial nation. And if we are to have development in India, the commitment should be first and foremost to the 375 million people who live under the most sad circumstances, economically, socially, politically. So to redefine development would mean where people whose resources are being utilized have a say in the process of development, where self-determination should be synonymous with development rather than antithetical to development. And one of the lovely things that we did in the two villages where we're working with where I'm working with watershed development with my village colleagues, is the first thing that they said is, we want to have a charter of development. And the first thing that they put on that charter was to say, nobody will be displaced. Because as you know, one of the most criminal things that has happened is that about 33 million people have been displaced since 1947 because of big development. Where do these people go? I worked in 89-90 with women in the slums in New Delhi, and it was one of the most profound things to see people so resilient and so much in resistance, and one of the most despairing things to see people completely dispossessed, disempowered, bereft, you know. And when I spoke with those people, the women there, part of what they kept reiterating is that it's too late. By the time we come to the slums and their support system and people talk about our empowerment, it's too late because we've lost any sense of future. We've lost any sense of self. So to redefine development would mean development that is for the people, development that is for righting, for correcting the injustices of history vis-a-vis caste, vis-a-vis gender inequities, vis-a-vis tribal inequities, vis-a-vis minority inequities.
And for that, you need some political movements, I would imagine.
That's the thing. See, India is one of the most vibrant in social movements. They are profound and prolific and profuse. But I think that they are seen as against the state, quote unquote. And that's tragic, because the state, instead of working with communities who are organizing locally, sees its business to work instead with multinational corporations, sees its business instead to work with bilateral agencies, sees its business instead to work with the World Bank. And if the state were to identify as a pro-people state, and the government certainly at the center in New Delhi now is not pro-people, it is instead pro-fundamentalism. You know, it's sort of the political arm of Hindu fundamentalists. That is who we have in power in a coalition government, but they have the majority. And this government certainly has not done anything to lead us to believe that it is committed to sustainable development. Big development is also not sustainable. And ironically, for example, in the case of dams, most of the quote-unquote Western world is intent on decommissioning large dams, while in India or China, we are intent on building them. So,
yeah. Well, that's what I thought when I was at the Asian Development Bank, actually the protests against the Asian Development Bank. It seems like there is so much terrible experience of displacing people and just wiping them out by building big dams that was coming to an end. Mm-hmm. So I was curious about how it's still going on in India.
There's a plan, you know, certainly for both liberalization. There's been strong liberalization since 1991. And India, as you know, traditionally had a mixed economy, and then it's been sort of increasingly liberalized. It's very much positioned. It has a strong middle class, and it is very much positioned to join globalization or welcome globalization. And it's not that I am advocating against globalization, but I'm certainly advocating for state responsibility, you know, and globalization, one is no longer sure of who has more rights. I am inclined to believe that corporations have far more rights than communities.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's pretty clear to me anyway.
Yes. And I think that if one is to talk about justice and peace, one needs to understand that wars are fought on the bodies of people, you know, not only through guns, but also through withholding survival resources, also through displacing them from their histories and from their homes and from their cultures. And it would require globalizing dissent would be a lovely thing on the part of progressive communities to form strong horizontal alliances where, for example, communities in the north who are struggling for environmental justice are very mindful of issues of race, are very mindful of race and racism when they are talking about certain changes. So it's not simply an advocacy on part of the environment, but it's also an advocacy on the part of righting the wrongs of imperialism or colonialization.
Do you think that that's likely to happen? When you say the north, you mean the northern part of the planet?
Yes. I think there are some organizations, for example, the International Rivers Network, which does incredible work, very much in solidarity with people's movements in the Global South. They're an organization that have been advocating against large dams. And those kinds of alliances are very, very necessary and very meaningful if we are to have justice, because it's only beginning where we are led to see how powerful corporations are becoming. It's sort of like the new mafia, in a sense, isn't it? And where we are also understanding that the state is very much becoming a corporate state. So then in that context, A, there needs to be dissemination of responsible information so people understand that it is not in their interest to adopt such forms of what one calls progress in the north or development in the global south. And so information, mobilization, organization to resist this, but not only to resist it in a reactive way, which I often find progressive communities, engage in, but to resist in systematic ways that also allow for alternatives, that also allow for people to have good living, that also allow for people to have dreams and have futures, but in a way that is sustainable to us and to the earth.
Well, definitely, that sounds good. I agree that that's what needs to happen. Making it happen, of course, is the challenge. Angana Chatterjee, you're in the Social and Cultural Anthropology program here, a professor at California Institute of Integral Studies, just to let people know who may be tuning in. And you're from India. I have to say that, you know, so many of the women that I interview, when I interview women, are from India. And that's very interesting to me. I've visited India for a month once, but as a place that I hear all these incredible stories of oppression of women, it's just so interesting to me that so many outspoken women, at least around here, are from India. Actually, I was in the first women's group of in 68 of the United States, and there was an Indian woman in there. So maybe you could comment on this.
I think, you know, as Michel Foucault once said, that the more entrenched the oppression, the more the possibilities of resistance. And I think it is precisely in the context where oppression is structurally, systemically situated deeply that it makes for vibrant forms of resistance. And I've heard other people mention that as well. I am very proud, inordinately so, to be a woman from India. I know that my parents were my father was a Gandhian socialist, and my mother was a very outspoken woman, and they both raised me to, as my father would often say, you have to violate what underpins people's imagination of what a woman can be, you know, violate that. So I think that is perhaps what breeds women to be powerful and resistant in India.
How nice that you had such a supportive family. Mm-hmm. Are you from a city, big city?
I'm from Calcutta. My family's been living in Calcutta since the early 1800s, yes. And also to say that it is not only urban women or those that are have received formal education that are empowered. I find in villages, for example, the most incredible strength, the most incredible forms of empowerment, where women are mobilizing to protect their forests, where women are mobilizing against a big development that is irresponsible, where women are speaking up in terms of gender oppression. So I think one of the things that I have learned is to be mindful of where resistance is and how to know how to look for it. Mm-hmm.
So is that part of your strategy, to see where resistance is and go there and help it along?
I think it would be according me too much credit by actually saying that I have a strategy. But I think when I was growing up, it became very evident that one can't work alone. And it became very evident that to work, you know, sort of the Gandhian strategy of build strength, as he would say that, you know, first they laugh at you, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, and then they fight you, and then you win. But to win, one has to have organization. And I've been very privileged to be part of social movements really all my life, and certainly to have always worked in conjunction with social movements. Yes, and I also think it pushes us to see ourselves differently, for example, as an academic. You know, I think the academy should be made more relevant than it is to social change. And I think one of the ways we are able to do that is through those forms of collaboration.
What about issues of women in India? Of course, issues of women, issues of people are issues of women. But if you could bring us up to date in your impression.
Mm-hmm. It's complex again because there's, as you mentioned, there are very powerful and empowered women. As I talked about, there are women's movements. There are women who are, you know, who stand up and who say no. And then there's also very entrenched and systemic forms of oppression against women, not just against women, against tribal people, against people of who are gay, lesbian, transgender, etc. And I think those are things we need to systematically rethink. And this is where intersections become so important. Like, for example, if we are talking about sustainable development, we must also make it our business that development is pro-women. You know, if we are talking about identity politics and we are talking about nationalism, that nationalism must also include a vision where gay and lesbian people, transgender people are equally honored. Do you see what I mean? And that's a very, very uphill battle. So I don't want to say that there is not resistance, but at the same time, I also want to point out the severity of oppression. I'll give you an example. Just a few months ago in Orissa, there was a little boy who had crawled from... He was of a lower, quote-unquote, lower caste community and had crawled and touched the well of an upper caste area of the village. And the boy was taken away by upper caste members of the village, pretty much held hostage, and until his father, quote-unquote, adequately apologized. What world are we living in, isn't it? There are still deaths that occur because bright women dowries are not sufficient or not deemed sufficient, or that women still have a price attached to them. And there are still incidences where women are burned at the funeral pyre, very rare, but they do occur, and they must be, you know, condemned, and one must struggle against sort of the whole notion of caste in India. To rethink that cannot only be a political or constitutional commitment. It has to be how we reorient our lives to live differently, and women's oppression is very linked to caste oppression.
How do you find racism in the United States compares to caste oppression?
caste, I think, was a form of discrimination connected to color, And India's just had a long practice with it, so we've gotten rather good at it. And I'm being ironic, of course. But in the United States, I think racism, certainly, again, there is prolific resistance to it, both on the part of communities of color and white allies. But also racism is a despairing fact of life, despairing and disgusting fact of life in this country. And there needs to be much greater mobilization. And that's why I'm very saddened to see and angered to see the actions of this government against affirmation. You know, there's been a very series of actions, actually, that have been anti-women, that have been anti-people of color. And it undermines what took this nation so long to get to, isn't it, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, all of that led to the construction of affirmative action. And I think it's slipping a little from our memory. It's slipping very badly from our memory.
It certainly is. I would like you also, if you would, Angona Chatterjee, comment on fundamentalism in wherever.
Wherever.
I was going to say India, but then I thought,
No, I think the responsible thing would be to speak to it specifically, because part of the mistake that we are making is to just talk about fundamentalism without situating it. And in this country, certainly, you know, at times Muslim becomes equatable with fundamentalist, which is extremely dangerous and problematic and simply wrong. And so I think when we talk about fundamentalism, it would be very important to situate it, and I, on my part, will talk about fundamentalism in India, because that is the responsible thing for me to do. It's complex, and it is not to say that fundamentalism is only the forte of Hindu right-wing communities in India. There are certainly Muslim fundamentalists who have undertaken action that is extremely dangerous and problematic. But I think that a majority community has a particular responsibility in a nation state. And Hindus are in a majority in India and therefore have a particular responsibility. What's frightening to me about Hindu fundamentalism in India is that it connects to nationalism. It connects to suddenly after Gujarat 2002 and the carnage against Muslim minorities, it has become acceptable in popular culture to talk about a Hindu India, which is not the commitment that we have made to history. India is a secular democracy, secular socialist republic, actually, in its constitution. But Hindu fundamentalism, there are various reasons for it. Colonialism, certainly, feudalism, globalization, forms of imperialism, all of that, but it doesn't excuse it. And it's the organization of Hindus across class and across caste toward building an India that accords them greater rights than it does minorities, which is absolutely cannot be supported, you know. And its vision linked to the nation state makes for a political culture where minorities are losing their rights. For example, the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party government at the center, or the government of Mr. Modi in Gujarat have done very little to atone for the carnage against Muslim minorities. And it becomes very dangerous because there's also the discourse that let Pakistan deal with Muslim fundamentalists, then we will deal with whatever problems there are with Hindu fundamentalism, and they are not equatable because Muslims in India must be accorded full rights, and that is a separate issue than Pakistan's and Islamic fundamentalism, which of course needs to be attended to.
Okay, well, we just don't have too much time left, but I would like you to speak about the Dialogues for Peace that you have put together here at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco.
It's a very small and I think important effort to get together a community, and it ranges from scholars, academics, activists, community members, and we've had a wonderful response. We had four Dialogues of Peace since September 11th, and it was a platform to put forward voices that are being marginalized and to build emancipatory community in the Bay Area. And we've had between 250 and 330 people show up to each one of them, and they've been quite profound and wonderful. And it's without the support of colleagues and activists in the Bay Area that it could not have happened. And we hope to continue, and the next one will be on September 19th, 2003.
When you say that they're dialogues, do you bring people who disagree with each other? Because I'm just interested in this. I mean, obviously, I'd like peace as much as anybody.
Mm-hmm. I think dialogue, that's one definition, that there are only two sides. But our assumption is that there are various nuances within the progressive community, and it's really a dialogue amongst progressive community to talk about our differences so we might be able to act for peace and justice.
Yeah, well, we definitely need as much solidarity as we can. Just coming over here, I was reading about, you know, consensus and how to make a community of we the people against the hierarchies all over the world, really.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Angana Chatterjee. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. To order a copy of the program you just heard, write down the following information. The email is sue@suesupriano.com. That's Sue, S-U-E, at Sue Supriano, SUESUPRIANO.com. Or the telephone is 510-883-1979. That's 510-883-1979.